I told you at the start of the 101 course that I was going to be rather ambitious, and tonight we're going to be covering several hundred years. So bear with me if I rattle through it a wee bit. We're going to be covering the birth of a nation. I slightly tongue-in-cheek labeled it the God's Empire Strikes Back. And so let's recap a little bit. As I said at the very start, we're dealing with a kind of hero's journey story. And that basically means it follows a pattern, that you have a crisis, the hero goes on a journey, and there's a kind of denouement, a kind of point at which, a climax to the story, at which the issue is resolved and the hero goes off home. So the kind of crisis that leads the hero of this story, that's humankind, to be on a journey, is that Adam and Eve get kicked out of Eden, and that's the first of many exiles we're going to encounter on this journey. They get kicked out because they try to claim equality with God. Now, let me be very clear about something. I've wanted to ban the word sin for an awful long time from an awful lot of debates because we really don't get that word. There's sin with a capital S and sins with a small s. Capital S means failing to worship God adequately and worshiping anything but God. That, in the Bible, is idolatry or sin with a capital S. The sins are the sign that we are guilty of being rebels against God. And I think if we grasp that, we wouldn't fall into the trap of calling certain things sins. But anyway, Adam and Eve blow it big style, and they're kicked out of Eden. Adam and Eve are sent out into the disorder and chaos where God has not completed the work of creation, the work of reclaiming or claiming that Adam was supposed to share in. And things degenerate from bad to worse. How many of you have siblings? Most of you. How many of you actually have had, well, some of you have got kids. There's an argument that I believe goes on in absolutely every household I know of. And I've used this illustration before, but it goes something like, kid number one comes home, plonks him or herself in front of the telly, switches on a program, decides that they could really do with a drink or a packet of crisps, gets up and goes to get the packet of crisps or the drink. Sibling two jumps into the chair. Sibling one comes back with packet of crisps or drink and says, "Get up. I was there first." Now, of course, in every household I know, sibling two jumps straight out of the chair and says, "Here you are. You're right enough." No? No, definitely no. And it really starts back there, because one of the things that happened after Adam and Eve get kicked out of Eden is that there's the first murder, and it all springs from sibling rivalry, a theme we're going to encounter again and again in this journey. Cain kills Abel and is sent even further out into the abyss. When humans are exiled from Eden, it damages not just the relationship with God, but it damages the relationship with each other. In fact, I would go as far as to say that without God, we become less human. And that one of the key things that Jesus came to do was to make us human again, to make us truly in the image of God. Now, it gets so bad that at one point, God almost decides to rip it all up and start again. But God finds one human being who trusts him and is obedient to him, and of course that's Noah. Noah and his family are saved by building an ark, a massive ship that sometimes in the last few years I've felt we should start building here in Gore Bridge, never mind anywhere else. But anyway, they build this massive ship, and when the planet is flooded, they are saved, and they save all the animals. Now, I want you to notice that in saving the animals, Noah is actually fulfilling God's mandate to Adam to look after the planet and to extend its borders, extend the borders of God's kingdom. And that takes us to the first of the patriarchs or fathers of the Jewish nation. Patriarchs is just a fancy word meaning fathers. You'll find it in Bibles and in theological books, but it simply means fathers. And Abraham is the subject of Act 3 of the play that I've indicated. It is the story of the Bible. Abraham, when we first meet him, is called Abram, and that's quite important. Here's the passage that I'd like us to kind of focus on. It's from Genesis chapter 12, the New Living Translation. The Lord had said to Abram, "Leave your native country, your relatives, and your father's family, and go to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you and make you famous, and you will be a blessing to others. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with contempt. All the families on earth will be blessed through you." So Abram departed as the Lord instructed, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. There's hope for old guys. He took his wife Sarai and his nephew Lot and all his wealth, his livestock and all the people he had taken into his household at Haran, and they headed to the land of Canaan. Abram's name change that we read about in Genesis 17 is actually an important detail, and we're going to see this again tonight. When people meet God personally, their identities are changed. They become, in some respects, different people, still the same and yet somehow different. And that's what happens to Abram. Abram goes from father exalted to father of multitudes or nations when God renews his promise to him, at which time he was 99. I'm just a youngster. It's great. I love these patriarchs. Abram's call, though, is a very important reminder to us that people are never called by God for their own benefit alone. Abram was not called for his sake. He was called to be the father of nations and to be a blessing to the nations. When we encounter God, we're called by God for a purpose, and that purpose is to benefit others. Abram's call is also a reminder that God is not owned by the Jews or even the church. Abram's promise that all the families on earth will be blessed through you. And Paul makes it very plain that that's now our job. We are to be a blessing to the nations. As I've already indicated, I find it rather comforting that Abram was 70 when he was first called, Genesis 12 and 4. Now that's another quite important point because it reminds us that there's no age limit on serving God. So often in churches as a minister, and I did encounter this a lot, folk will say to you, "I've done my bit. It's now time to hand over to the young people." That's not the way it goes at all. You're never done. I used to tell them in response that the retirement age for Christian service is a wooden box. So Abram sets out to the promised land that, as we saw, has very deliberate echoes of Eden, the Euphrates River being one of its boundaries, and we get the boundaries of Abram's promised land from Genesis 15, 18 to 19. But a thing that you'll notice if you read the story is that Abram was a real flesh and blood man. That's one of the things I love about the Bible. You don't encounter plaster saints in the Bible. All the great figures of the Bible are men or women with feet of clay. And Abram was no exception. He had moments where he failed to trust God. And if you read the story, you'll see that he was very capable of deceit and things that are not worthy. Abram was promised a family, but he and Sarai, and she's the second name change that I want to point out for you tonight, she becomes Sarah. He and Sarah became, as they thought, too old to have a child. So Abram decides to do God's work in his way. Now, that's something I think many of us have been guilty of, particularly if you've been a minister for any length of time. You'll know how that one goes. God promises you something, and you get impatient, and you try to do it your way and in your strength, and it never works. So Abraham was guilty of that, and he slept with Hagar, Sarai's servant, and had a son called Ishmael. Abram doubted God, and there were consequences that may even reverberate right down to today. Many people believe that the Arab nation descended from Ishmael, and many Muslims believe that Muhammad, as such, was a descendant of Ishmael. So the enmity between Jews and Arabs, Jews and Muslims, might actually go right back to Abram. However, God renewed his covenant with Abram and changed his name. And in his old age, he had a son that he called Isaac. But all that said about Abram, the thing that we need to note about Abram is he set out from a place of comfort on a journey into the unknown, trusting God. And we're told in Genesis 15 and 16, that, as Paul picks up on, that Abraham, if you like, is a prototype Christian. Abraham was justified by faith, not by his exemplary character, as I've already suggested. He didn't have that. I've just given you a wee map to let you see the journey that Abram embarked on. Ur is down there by the Persian Gulf in present-day Iraq, and he set out across the Arabian Desert. Well, he might have gone another route, but he certainly has to go many, many miles across there to the other arrow in Canaan. Abram's faith and willingness to trust God meant that no sacrifice to him was too great. Abram was also really a great worshiper. He was justified by faith, and he was a worshiper. He trusted God, and he worshipped him. There's a very strange tale that we're told that tells us that Abram was prepared to sacrifice his only son, the one that he conceived in his great age. And it's a strange tale that's echoed in the gospel because, of course, we know that God sacrificed his son for us. And that takes us to Act 3, scene 2-ish. I say that because actually scene 1 isn't really scene 1 anyway. There are several wonderful stories before you reach Abraham. And before we get to the next character that I want to focus on a bit, Moses, there are some great stories. I'm going to touch on a few of them before we get to Moses. So I've called it Act 3, scene 2-ish. It's two for the purposes of my thinking, but it's not really two from the point of view of the Bible. But do check it out. It's a wonderful set of stories. And we start with Isaac. That's Abram's son that Abram was prepared to sacrifice for his worship of God. And Isaac had two sons, Esau and Jacob. And guess what? They didn't get along. It's another story of sibling rivalry. And this time, Jacob, who is not the most endearing of characters when you read his story, is a bit of a sleek-it character, as we'd say in Scots, and he cheats Esau out of his birthright. Much later, on the way to an attempted reconciliation, Jacob encounters God in a desert. Now, deserts are very important places in the Bible. Deserts are often places of encounter with God and places where people are commissioned. That's something we're going to touch on again in a few moments. Jacob was renamed by God Israel, one who strives with God, because again, if you know the story, Jacob's encounter with God meant wrestling with an angel all night, and he is renamed by God, one who strives with God, in honor of that wrestling bout that he had. But note there again, we have another new name. Jacob becomes Israel. And Jacob, or Israel, had 12 sons. Guess what? They didn't get along. Again, the story of Jacob, or Israel's sons, is one of sibling rivalry. You know, there's another key point here. Abram's family is pretty dysfunctional. And That actually, I think, is quite instructive. It demonstrates that God chooses people not because they're special, not because of any merits that they may have, but because they're willing to serve and trust God. So Abram's family are pretty dysfunctional, and as I say, I think that suggests that God chooses people not because of their merits. Jacob, or Israel's youngest son, Joseph, of Technicolor Dreamcoat fame, had dreams and had the gift of interpreting dreams. Joseph, as we first encountered him, not to put too fine a point on it, is a total pain. He is a right wee horror. He uses his gift arrogantly to exalt himself above his brothers, and he revels in being his father's favorite. His brothers, not surprisingly, are jealous, and that leads them to decide to bump him off. The eldest, Judah, has a bit of a bad conscience about that and persuades them just to dump him down a well, and that's what they do. He did intend to go back from later, but it never happened. Instead, Joseph is rescued and taken off to Egypt as a slave. In Egypt, initially, Joseph thrives, but in a story that has an extraordinary contemporary flavor to it, he's accused of rape by his master's wife, who'd been trying to seduce him for all she was worth. And poor old Joseph ends up wrongly convicted and is off to prison. Joseph's ability to interpret dreams ends up with him becoming effectively what today would be the prime minister of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. Now, during a famine, due to Joseph's wisdom, Egypt has food in plenty, food aplenty in store, and Joseph decides to bring his family to live with him in Egypt. There's a great story, do read it, where they come to Egypt, Joseph's family come to Egypt looking for food, and Joseph doesn't let on who he is. It's a really great story. Do check it out. But the story of Joseph gives us some hints about why sometimes bad things happen to God's people. God's hand was on Joseph, and yet, as you've seen, he ends up down a well, dumped there by his brothers. He ends up in prison, falsely accused of rape. He has a pretty hard time, but all of that strengthens him and ultimately gives Joseph the place to be able to rescue his family and become a very important person in the story of the nation Israel. In Egypt, Joseph's family prosper and grow into a nation from being a family. However, they're perceived of as an immigrant threat. Of course, people today are so much more sophisticated than that, aren't they? I think not. Anyway, in Egypt, these Jews prosper, and we get a good dose of anti-Semitism. Again, something we've never encountered in our day and generation. The Israelites become slaves because they become victimized and end up being made slaves, but they still thrive. So Pharaoh decides to cull them, and his chosen method is to have all the Israelite baby boys killed off. One boy escapes in an extraordinary echo of the story of Jesus escaping Herod's similar attempt to deal with what Herod saw as a threat. Moses, as the boy was called, was left in a basket in a story that I'm sure most of you who went to Sunday school will remember. And Moses is discovered by Pharaoh's daughter, who adopts him, and Moses grows up as in the film of the same name, a prince in Egypt. There's another Sunday school type picture of Moses in the basket. And to this day, baskets for babies are called Moses baskets. It's amazing how much influence the Bible's had even on people who don't even recognize the illusion. Moses, like Noah, points to Jesus. But here's the thing about Moses. Just like Abraham, Moses is flawed. Now, I think that is something we really need to get a hold of here. The Bible is no whitewash job on these characters. The heroes of the Bible, all bar one, are flawed people. I think that speaks very highly of the honesty and the integrity of the Bible. Abram was flawed. Moses is flawed. And Moses loses his temper at the treatment of his people, the Israelites, and he murders an Egyptian guard. Moses flees Egypt as an outlaw, and guess what? In the desert, he encounters God in a burning bush that is not consumed by the flames. The story can be found in Exodus 3. At this time, God reveals himself to Moses as the God who is. That's the most important name the Bible gives to God. I am who I am, the God who is. And that, again, is a kind of rebuttal of idolatry. The God that we worship as Christians and who was worshipped by the Jews before us is the real one, the one who is, not the one made with human hands. Now, I love this story. This story absolutely, totally resonates with me. I became a minister because I heard a sermon in Holyrood Church, Edinburgh, and the sermon was basically to praise it a wee bit. Here am I, Lord, send Aaron. It was a story of Moses arguing with God and saying, don't call me. I'm no good at public speaking. Go and find somebody else. And I had just that argument with God some 37 or 8 years ago. I lost 2, by the way. I heard the same story, or the same sermon, rather, just a few months later in Orkney at my friend's wedding in a Baptist church in Orkney. So I did eventually get the message that God was telling me what he told Moses, which is effectively, if I made your mouth, you can use it the way I tell you to. So God is insistent with Moses, and Moses, with the help of his more eloquent brother Aaron, goes on to become the leader of the Israelites. Moses, too, is elderly when he begins his life's work. Exodus 7 and 7 tells us that Moses was 80 at this point. And there follows a series of plagues that were sent to persuade Pharaoh to release the Israelites. The final plague is an eerie echo of Pharaoh's attempted cull of the Israelites. And all the firstborn males in Egypt die. Only the firstborn males of the Israelites, protected by the blood of a sacrificial lamb painted on the door frames, survive. Now that's, again, an important echo back to what happened in the New Testament, and the blood of another ram, a lamb, is the protection for God's people. This event was preceded by a Passover meal that Jesus reinterpreted and applied to his own cross. Finally, Pharaoh agrees to let the Israelites leave Egypt. The next episode in the story is a 40-year wandering, again where? A desert, a place of preparation, a place of commissioning. And during that time that they spend in the desert, God gives Moses the law that defined Israel as God's people. And many parts of the law are passages that are meant to separate Jews from the other nations, like circumcision and the food they could and couldn't eat. And this episode ends with Moses' successor, Joshua, Jesus' Hebrew name, and that, again, is quite important. Joshua, Yeshua would have been the name that Joshua had and the name that Jesus had, Yeshua, which when we transliterate it into English, becomes Joshua and became, in Latin, Jesus. And Joshua leads Israel back into the promised land. Do you see echoes of something yet to happen? Now, Let's just remember some of the lessons from the story so far. God chooses people who trust him, not people who are perfect. Abram's family are dysfunctional, and so is the nation that they become. And all of the heroes of the Old Testament are a bit flawed. And that reminds us that God does work with people who are not perfect. Of course, if we are following Jesus with the help of the Holy Spirit, we're supposed to be becoming more like Jesus, but not perfect this side of heaven or this side of Jesus returning. God chooses people for the sake of others. God chooses people who are old and young. I used to wind up some of the older folk in the congregations I was minister of by pointing out that Jesus experienced everything that human beings have experienced except one thing, something I'm now experiencing, old age. Christianity has often been at its best as a youth movement, but Moses, Abraham, and all these guys were old. So God chooses people from all generations to serve him. Even in the desert, and that was considered, as we saw on the first session, a place of non-existence, God is there. In the harshest and worst places that we can be in our lives, God is there and can use those harsh experiences to hone us and to commission us and to equip us. Noah, Moses, and Joshua all point forward to Jesus. They rescued people, and Moses is a prophet and a great leader. The pattern of rebellion against God, followed by exile, with the desert often being a place of encounter, preparation, commissioning, is one that we're going to see again and again as we follow this story of the long journey home for God's people. The end. Question time.